Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Munch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine, and for the first time, by Chris Orr, who is filling in for Alyssa on her maternity leave. Chris, say hi to the people.
Hello, everyone.
This is Chris. We're excited to have him here for the next, 6 weeks, 2 months. We'll see how long it takes Alyssa to get back. But thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it. First up in, controversies, not really controversies and non-controversies here. Tragedy struck the set of the film Rust, which stars Alec Baldwin, when director of photography Galena Hutchins was killed and director Joel Souza was wounded when the gun Baldwin was using in a scene accidentally discharged. There are a lot of different things to discuss here. The question of on-set safety is the big one, of course, and it's clear that there was much to be desired on that front. According to the Los Angeles Times, cameramen had walked off the set to protest the lack of safety, meetings, the long hours, and a previous accidental discharge on set by Baldwin's stunt double. I've been on a handful of sets, and one thing that has always jumped out to me is that whenever there is a weapon involved, the number of safety protocols that are supposed to be in place are very large and very redundant. Weapons should rarely be hot, that is loaded, and when they are hot, everyone on set should know that. You should have a bunch of people running around yelling, hot weapon, hot weapon. As soon as the scene is over, that weapon should be returned back to the armorer or prop master or whoever is in charge of them. Reporting thus far suggests that Baldwin believed his weapon to be unloaded, suggesting that Alec Baldwin, actor, might be in the clear in this situation. But Alec Baldwin, producer, is very much not in the clear. Safety measures had clearly broken down. There were concerns on set. And look, somebody died. Somebody has messed up very badly here. Baldwin and the armorer and the prop master are going to have a lot of explaining to do. And if I had to guess, there's going to be a few lawsuits in the offing. A secondary issue here is the way the whole matter was treated in media, both social and traditional. Many people treated this like a tragedy. Most people did. A handful, like Ohio Senate hopeful J.D. Vance, treated it as an opportunity to crack wise about Alec Baldwin's liberalism. Others, like notorious Twitter scolds, Aura Bogato, she decided to use this as a chance to highlight Baldwin's sexism for remembering the fact that this woman was a mother in addition to being a valued colleague. It is, as many of these things are, kind of weirdly ugly. Even the traditional media, like I said, got in on the act. The New York Times kind of darkly hinted that, Alec Baldwin had a history of temper on set, as if to suggest that he had shot these people in a fit of anger or something. It was weird. It was a weird time. Chris, what are some of the takeaways here? What should we be kind of keeping in mind from both a journalism perspective and just a movie appreciation perspective as we're watching this story unfold?
Sure. Well, I mean, as you mentioned, I think the number one thing here is the question of just gun safety on set. And I do think it's worth noting that despite the literally thousands upon thousands of rounds, most of them blanks and some of them not live rounds at all, that are shot in film and on television every single year. This is the third episode that I can recall of somebody being severely injured or killed. Obviously, Brandon Lee in The Crow, Bruce Lee's son, was shot when accidentally there was an actual bullet in the chamber of the gun in front of the blank that was supposed to be firing, and he was killed. And then back earlier, and a bit less famously, John Eric Hexum, you guys probably don't remember his show. I think it was called Cover Up. It was not a good show. But shot himself in the head with a blank because he evidently didn't know that a blank actually was a cardboard piece of paper, which would decelerate very quickly with air pressure. But if you put it right up against your temple, it would go straight into your brain and kill you. And that's what happened with him. So, I think it's worth noting that it's incredibly rare that something like this happens. I mean, one in 100,000, one in a million. And the reason is, as you said, Sonny, there are very clear precautions on set, as there should be. I think the commentary about Alec Baldwin kind of falls into three categories. I mean, and the one is that people wanting to score cheap political points. You mentioned J.D. Vance saying, we need Trump back on Twitter because that famed wit and humorist would undoubtedly have something extremely clever to say about Alec Baldwin. That's all nonsense. His politics don't matter. I mean, if it had been Mel Gibson, you'd have an entirely different crowd of people crowing about it. I think the idea that he did this in a violent rage is, again, from the little we know, and there's a lot we don't know, is also just absurd. There's no evidence that I've seen that remotely supports that. You know, I do think, however, I mean, he has a pretty well-established history as a, you know, a narcissist and occasionally a bully and a selfish human being. And we know that on his set, safety was a very low priority, and there'd been members of the crew who had complained and walked off the set. And I do think that's relevant. And insofar as you can portray Alec Baldwin, and I think you can, as a selfish man with very little concern for others, it does kind of play into this. I mean, if the producer of this film had been Tom Hanks and this had happened, I think we would all be completely flabbergasted in a way that we're not. We hear about this with Alec Baldwin, and I think on some level there's a, Alec Baldwin kind of sounds like the kind of guy who, if he were a producer of a movie, might be a little sloppy and not that worried about the safety of his crew. So again, there are a lot of details we don't know. I think you're right. Yeah. There will almost certainly be lots of litigation. And I don't want to prejudge Alec Baldwin in any way, but I'm not sure it's absurd to point out that this is a guy with something of a history of sort of selfishness.
Yeah, Peter, what are you, there's also a labor aspect to all of this. There was talk of the IATSE members who were part of the film crew had were the ones who walked off the set. They were replaced by non-union members, I think, like the morning of or the day before this all happened. So there is also kind of a labor rights issue here.
Well, I think it's worth separating some of the labor rights issues from the specific weapons safety issues, and they are possibly related here, but I don't think they are, that the overlap is exactly the same, because it seems to me that what the people who walked off the set were complaining about mostly was intolerably long hours, which are themselves a kind of safety issue. They were talking about, right, having to drive 50 miles back after 12 to 14 hour days, but it's a different kind of safety issue. It's not the one that was most relevant here. And the concerns that I think are the most relevant here are, people said the weapons that we have on set are not being handled safely. There was a prior unintended discharge. So we don't know all the details. We don't know how big a concern this was. And frankly, I'm not somebody who has worked on movie sets, all of my life. So I don't have 10 years worth of movie sets experience to know exactly how unusual the complaints were or the issues with the firearm safety on set were at all. On the other hand, the fact that people had them is relevant. The fact that there was a discharge that was not intended, that's a very big deal, actually. I mean, right? Like if you're at a gun range and a gun goes off and someone didn't mean to, even if there's absolutely no damage to anything, that even if it's completely fine, if that happens, everything needs to shut down right now and everybody needs to find out what's going on, right? Like, and so, so I work for Reason Magazine, which is like a notably pro-gun ownership, pro-Second Amendment publication. But one of the things that I have learned as a non-gun owner who works at this publication, who has a lot of gun owner friends, a bunch of pals in Kentucky who are collectors and shooters, but I'm not a gun owner myself, but whenever we publish anything about guns and gun rights, especially if there is an image involved, our gun-owning readers will write in mass to correct even the tiniest breach of safety protocol that is shown in a stock image, right? And so this is actually a useful thing for me to understand, is that gun owners, the majority of them, the ones who care about this stuff, are and should be correct, incredibly obsessed with the extremely fine points of gun safety. And to take that even a little bit carelessly, right, to be just a little bit lax, is a huge violation of protocol. And again, I don't know whether, somebody very slightly mishandled this weapon is actually a common thing on an indie film with a bunch of violence, right, with some OK Corral type shootouts. But the thing that I've learned from a lot of interaction with pretty serious gun owners and shooters, folks who for whom this is like a hobby and avocation and a lifestyle, is that you have to be completely obsessed at every minute, and that even the smallest breach of protocol is simply not acceptable, and that you have to stop, start over, and see what's going on, regardless of whether there actually appears to be even like the a small chance, or like again, like I was saying, if a gun goes off on a gun range and nothing bad happens at all, and even if it kind of hits a target, if it was unintended, if somebody did something accidentally, if it was out of right, if it was a thing that wasn't intended to happen, that's really bad, and you have to like see what like you have to go investigate that immediately. And it seems like maybe that didn't happen on this set.
You mentioned time. Time is a big factor on a film production just in general. Time is money. Time is literally money when it comes to making movies.
Incredibly expensive, longer, even at the lowest budget.
The more days that it takes you to shoot something, the more expensive a thing is. That's just how it works. And so the argument that, you know, safety corners were being cut, safety meetings were being skipped is one thing that I have heard, that they were not nearly enough safety meetings, which is where, you know, you will have an armorer gather the crew and say, here are the things you need to be doing when you're given a live gun. You need to check to see if there are bullets in it. You need to check to see what kind of bullets there are in it. If it is live, if it is hot, you need to ensure that the right kind of round is in it. You need to know where you're firing, you know, all of this stuff. And a competent armorer will be able to say to a director or the first AD who is you know, kind of the guy who was in charge of safety, the first assistant director, or the
also the XO, or the, right, like he's Denzel Washington in Crimson Tide,
right, or the cinematographer who is always going to be around the camera and always going to be kind of looking through the viewfinder. Like, a competent armorer will be able to say, this shot that you are trying to do is safe or unsafe, and if it is unsafe, you need to do it the proper way. So again, it just like the issue, you know, a lot of people are throwing around ideas like, oh, we need to get rid of guns entirely off of sets, or oh, we need to ensure that all muzzle flashes are done in post, and all, you know, all of this kind of beats around the bush, which is the real problem, is that if you do not take safety seriously, and if you treat guns with anything less than utmost respect, somebody is more likely to get hurt. Even if that likelihood is still pretty small. And I don't know. That's just the big takeaway from this for me.
The case that Chris mentioned earlier, where the guy from Cover Up, shot himself, was because he was joking around. He just picked up a gun and was like, wouldn't it be funny? And did not realize. And it was a breach of safety protocol because he wasn't taking it seriously.
I believe his exact line, and again, I'm digging back into my memory of the event in 1984, but I believe his exact line was, I wonder if there's one in here for me. And he said it grinning, thinking that a gun with blanks was totally safe, and he shot himself in the brain and died immediately.
Yeah.
I would just add one more thing, Sonny. You mentioned the assistant director, and I'm not going to mention his name,
really,
in part because I don't recall it immediately, and in part because I don't want to make him famous before we know more about what happened. But the assistant director who, it appears, handed the gun to Baldwin and declared the gun safe, shouted out cold gun. Apparently there had been concerns with his safety record on previous sets. So again, who is to blame for this is, I think, a very open question. But I mean, as you've both noted, something went horrifically, terribly wrong. And again, I'm not sure that this means that, you know, actual handguns can't be used in film anymore and it should all be digitized or something like that. Because again, we're talking three deaths in, you know, 30 plus years. But
I mean, this is the thing. Sets are actually incredibly safe. I mean, considering the incredibly dangerous stuff you oftentimes see, you know, take place on screen, the relatively small number of like stuntman deaths and serious injuries is a relatively, again, good sign that things are usually done right. But when they're done wrong, somebody needs to be held accountable. And like, whether it's criminal or civil, you know, I leave that up to the courts and everybody else. But somebody on this set is and should be in a fairly large amount of trouble. And until we know more, I don't think we'll know exactly who that person is. But somebody needs to pay for this, because a terrible thing has happened. All right. Again, this is not really controversy or non-controversy. It just is what it is. It's obviously a controversy. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com. We're going to have a special bonus episode talking about our favorite movies by the director Denis Villeneuve. That's how I'm going to pronounce it every time. Speaking of which, on to the main event, Dune. Or I should say Dune Part 1, as some surprised moviegoers learned when the title card popped onto the screen. That's right, folks. Unless you have been reading the trades and the nerd blogs, you might have missed that this is only the first half of the adaptation of Frank Herbert's book Dune. You might have missed that because the marketing has been, I don't want to say deceptive, but not exactly forthcoming. In none of the ads, none of the posters, none of the trailers has this film been described as its full title, Dune Part 1. It's just been Dune. And on some of the posters, there were It Begins. And you're like, oh, It Begins? Okay, sure. But Dune, just Dune. It's a minor issue. Because this is very much one half of one movie. And look, I liked this one half of one movie. Denis Villeneuve knows how to make a film look good. Every single image is conveying information, and the whole thing zips along from scene to scene, despite the 2.5 hours. And despite the fact that this is only one half of one story, the pacing is very solid. It's never boring. We see the Harkonnens leave Arrakis, where the spice needed for interstellar travel is mined. We see House Atreides arrive. And then we see the Harkonnens come back a few minutes later and like, no, we're actually going to kill all of you. Sucks to be you. You jerks. I would argue that we don't get nearly enough of the political intrigue to understand why all of this is happening, why Duke Leto, who is played by Oscar Isaac, is set up for murder by the Emperor, and why the Harkonnens, led by their Baron, who's played by Stellan Skarsgård, are, you know, there and doing their things. We don't really understand the importance of Paul, played by Timothy Chalamet, to the Bene Gesserit, an order of witches, to which Paul's mother Jessica belongs. We don't really even get much of a sense of why the spice itself is important. This is what is being fought over. We just know it's needed for space travel, and it's expensive. So sure, why not? I don't mind all this, honestly, because everything that's happening on screen is so interesting. I love the way Skarsgård is channeling Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now as a Baron Harkonnen. And I'm like the actor I was actually most impressed by in this movie is Jason Momoa, who is not in it a ton, but his evolution into a genuine A-list screen presence hits its high water mark here. Oscar Isaac continues to have a great year. Rebecca Ferguson is a delight as Jessica. Again, the real problem with this movie is that it just kind of stops. It doesn't even leave on a cliffhanger. It just like kind of stops. And I don't think that would be too much of an issue if the sequel were already shot and we were just waiting 6 months or so for it to drop, a la The Matrix Revolutions or Kill Bill Volume 2 or the Lord of the Rings movies, right? You do it all back to back. It's there. You understand that this is part one of a two-part series and boom, it's great. I'll be very blunt. I don't blame people if they feel a little bit tricked by this. That said, still pretty good. Peter, how many times have you watched it by now? Have you watched it 10 times yet? Have you watched it in IMAX and on your phone and on your TV and on a iPod video player that you own?
So I've seen it twice, and by the time this episode airs, I will have seen it a third time. Oh. Once in a theater, once at home already, and I'm going to see it in a great Dolby theater here in Washington, D.C. that has, I think, the best sound system in the area, in part because this is such a great sound movie. I mean, we've talked about the visuals, but this is a movie that wouldn't work the same way without an incredible score and also just an incredible soundscape. And it's notable that the movie actually starts before the title screen rolls, before you even see the Warner Brothers logo. It actually starts on a black screen with a weird sound, right? And it's the sound of like weird Dune language or something, right? Like, there's a little translation and it's something about dreams or whatever before, but like the first thing that happens is not an image in this movie. It is a sound, because this movie is communicating with you as much through its sound choices and through its soundscape as through the images. I absolutely loved it. And I agree with some of your criticisms. In particular, I think the movie doesn't feel finished. It really feels like the greatest pilot ever shot in some ways, right? Like I want to watch 10 episodes of this, even though we're probably only going to get one more and that'll be that. At the same time, everything that's there works so exceptionally well. I'm completely willing to forgive, some of the lack of detail about the political intrigue. I mean, it's actually sort of notable how little exposition there is in this movie. Yes, there's some film books where you know, the sandworms and walking on that, you know, how to do the Fremen weird, you know, Ministry of Silly Walks dance over the dunes is explained. But this movie does not fall into the trap that it easily could have and just been a whole bunch of exposition. Instead, it just sort of walks you through what's happening and lets you figure it out. And it actually removes a bunch of the stuff that's in the book. For example, unless I'm just completely mistaken, the word Mentats is never spoken in this movie. And instead, you have Thor, anyway, I can never remember that guy's exact name, but he shows up there at the beginning, right? He's like counting the amount of, you know, spice dollars that they would have had to spend for the Empire to come and bring the proclamation themselves. And his eyes just go white for a little bit. And that's it. That's the only way that you sort of get that referenced. And it's really smart to just kind of say, here's just let it be in the world and not say, okay, and now we're going to have somebody say, wow, isn't it great that you used your Mentat powers? Let's have a little dialogue about explaining Mentats and what they are and their place in this world, how they're kind of advisors to the various houses, blah, blah. Like, no, the movie's just like, no, we're just going to hope the audience gets it by the way we stage these scenes. And the scenes are all staged so stunningly that it almost doesn't matter like what's happening or like sort of the plot or the through line or whether you fully grasp every little detail and how it relates to the book. Every single image and sound in this movie just works beautifully. And that's what I want from movies, especially from big movies. And that's why I have seen it twice already and we'll see it at least a couple more times here, even before it leaves the theatrical run.
Chris, what did you make of Dune?
You know, I would say I basically agree with most of what both of you have said. I mean, I did think it was really striking that the last line in the movie, if I recall correctly, is Zendaya saying, "This is only the beginning." And obviously that's intended as a sort of slightly cheeky inside joke.
Yeah.
But it's also completely the truth. It's not a joke so much as a statement of fact, which is we've just given you a 2.5-hour prologue. It's not only that it's the first half of the book, but I think it's the less important half of the book. It's the more setting up what will take, you know, in establishing the universe part of the book and a huge amount of what happens in the first book. And it should be noted also that there are there are 5 or 6 sequels that Frank Herbert wrote himself and many more that his son wrote. So if Denis Villeneuve wanted to and could get a revenue stream, he could keep making Dune movies for the next 35 years.
We can only hope.
So I agree. I do think it was a little bit of a
Netflix is Netflix will buy anything, right?
I mean, I completely agree with you, Sonny. I do think it felt like a bit of a bait and switch where you're sort of just, I mean, yeah. I think to some degree, you're just entering the meat of the story. You're sort of just getting at the point where exciting things are going to happen. And then they sort of say like, oh, this is only the beginning and the credits are on.
I mean, the funny thing is, I knew that it was they had only filmed half the book because I do read Deadline and I read, you know, Collider. I've seen all the stories and they have not been hiding this in interviews or anything. But they have. I mean, I would argue they have literally been hiding it from the advertising campaign. This has not been marketed as Dune Part One. It's been marketed as Dune,
yeah.
And that I don't blame folks for not being thrilled by that when they get there and the first image, the first after the sound, is Dune Part One. They're like, wait, Part One? I don't know. It's a little thing. And I would actually have less of a problem if it just ended on a straight up cliffhanger. If it just ended with him like starting his fight with the Fremen, is he going to die or whatever? But like ending it where they ended, it's just like, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Done with this.
Well, I completely agree with you on that, Sonny. But I also want to say, I also completely agree with Peter. It is an immersive experience. It is less a sort of narrative-driven experience than just, this is the single movie of the year that if you're going to see any movie in theaters, this is the one to see in a theater. It's visually absolutely astonishing. The score, which is by Hans Zimmer, I actually hadn't known that for certain. I had thought it might be by Johan Johansson, the Icelandic composer who did Arrival, because like that, it's not a musical score. It is just an immersive score of booming noises and buzzing. And it creates a mood that is extremely powerful. And there are only a few scenes that don't have music, including the fight at the end with the Fremen, where it is very striking that you've sort of been in this immersive soundscape for 2+ hours, and suddenly you just hear two people sort of scuffling around and fighting, it's a clever inversion of the usual thing where you would have the score get louder during the fight. I would just add that I have rarely seen a film that I think is more of a director's film and less of an actor's film. There are actors in this movie whom I absolutely adore. Oscar Isaac, you guys mentioned, I think, and you guys have spoken about this earlier, but I think The Card Counter is the best film I've seen this year, and his performance in it is the best performance I've seen this year. I think Oscar Isaac is a monstrous talent, and maybe the worst thing about the last Star Wars trilogy is that it gave him absolutely not one single useful thing to do and took up basically a decade of his career. I think he's fantastic. On the other hand, I'm a bit cool, at least relative to most people, on Timothée Chalamet. I'm still sort of waiting to be wowed by him. But it doesn't matter. I mean, in either case, or in Rebecca Ferguson, the Swedish actress who plays Leto's wife and Paul's mother. It's not that any of the performances are bad by any stretch. It's just that they don't really matter on some level, because what he is doing is just establishing a look and again, a soundscape that is incredibly powerful. It's quite similar to what he did in his previous and I think very underrated film, Blade Runner 2049. But it's really potent. I mean, it did not feel like a 2.5-hour movie to me, despite the fact that it had maybe 45 minutes worth of genuine plot in it. It didn't feel long. I didn't get bored. Now, that won't be true of everyone.
I mean, Blade Runner 2049, similarly, just speeds along despite being, I think, 2 hours and 43 minutes, something like that, you know? And so, his pacing's really good.
He makes long movies that are paced very well, which is impressive. Peter, we're talking about the soundscape a lot, and I want us to make briefly the argument for seeing this in IMAX or Dolby or some other format, as opposed to seeing it at home. The thing that jumps out at me is watching this in a theater when either Jessica or Timothy or the head Bene Gesserit, which whatever, I forget her name, uses the voice, the psychological trick that compels people to behave. It rumbles right through you. I mean, it is like an actual physical sensation in a theater. And I haven't watched it at home yet. I cannot imagine how that plays the same at home as it does in theaters.
Yeah, so I have a very good sound system. I mean, a really, really good, a 9.1 Dolby Atmos sound system in my basement with very good speakers, including a very large subwoofer. And I can produce an effect that is, I want to say, somewhat comparable. And yet, it still doesn't have the kind of raw power that it just has seeing it, first of all, with the much bigger screen. I've got, you know, a nice OLED television, but it's not like I have a movie theater in my house. And there's also just something about seeing it in the company of other people. And so this is, multiple other people, some of whom are strangers, experiencing that crazy, crazy sound with you. There is it's not quite like a rock concert, but in the same way that if you see your favorite band play a song that you know and it sounds pretty much just like it does on a CD, there's still something different seeing it happen there with other people in attendance and experiencing it together. And I think most people's sound systems just will not be able to process this soundscape in a way that reflects the intent and power of the original, of what you're going to get in even a just okay movie theater, much less, you know, a Dolby theater. Even if you have a really, really good sound system at home, it's different and better in the theater. I can say this as someone who has a good sound system and has seen it both at home and in a theater. It's just notably different. And this is a movie that, like I said, I bought tickets for a second in theater show pretty much as soon as I got out of the press screening.
Well, Peter, first, let me just say I'm awaiting an invitation to your basement to watch all of my favorite movies. But did we want to talk just briefly about prior attempts to do Dune and why it was sort of seen as an unfilmable movie? I saw the David Lynch one in theaters, and I guess I was in.
Oh, wow. What was that? So like, how did people respond? So I mean, I saw that movie, you know, when I was 12 on VHS and have seen it a number of times since. And so I'm pretty familiar with that movie. And that was actually my first experience with a story. I didn't read the book until I was an adult. How was that movie received at the time?
It was not received well. Now, I had a slightly unique experience in that I had a stomach bug and had to leave the theater to go to the bathroom for about 15 minutes. And was just
so you actually understood it better than anybody else.
I am not blaming the movie for my intestinal distress, although it certainly did not help my intestinal distress. It was a mess of a movie. People didn't like it, and it went the exact opposite way. I think, well, maybe not the exact opposite way, but as Sonny, you were pointing out that that Villeneuve's film does not spend a lot of time explaining the politics. And overall, I think that's the right choice because you can just get bogged down in exposition forever. And that was, I think, what happened a lot with the David Lynch movie. And then obviously there was the Jodorowsky movie that never got made, but led to the delightful documentary about its failure to be made, Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah.
And although he did not advertise it at the time, his plan was that the movie would be 14 hours long.
Of course, as one would expect from Jodorowsky.
I hope that Dune Part 2 is the next 11 and a half hours of this, right? And that we will
let me just give you one.
That we will finally get Jodorowsky's vision here. And in fact, when the other time that this was made was as a miniseries for the Sci-Fi Channel, which I don't know if you guys have seen that.
I've not seen
parts of it. I don't know that I watched it all the way through. It's not bad and it's not great either. And it has the advantage of having a much longer time, but it's a Sci-Fi Channel movie. Again, not made on the cheapest possible, like Sharknado level budget, but it just does. The filmmakers just did not have the resources, even really, that David Lynch had in terms of dollars per shot. And it shows.
I have one little bit of trivia that I need to sneak in here, which is that the producer for Jodorowsky's Dune, which again was never made, but the producer was Michel Seydoux, who is the granduncle of Léa Seydoux, whom you guys spoke about recently with the last Bond movie and who we all will be talking about next week with the French Dispatch. So,
yes, it's the month of Chalamet. This week, my one acting critique was I thought Dave Bautista in this movie is used weirdly badly. I thought Bautista is the best part of Blade Runner 2049, which is a good movie. I think one of the best movies of that year. And the way Villeneuve used him in that movie as kind of a quieter, and then suddenly violent, you know, person is a little bit better than how he is used here, which is kind of as a screaming.
He's a heavy. You know, he's a Bond villain.
Yeah, it's.
But he looks great, right?
Well,
and,
sure.
And this is, I mean, this to me justifies the somewhat underutilization of his talents as an acting personality. Is that he just sort of carries the weight of that, you know, of the
beast
of the young, yes, of that type of character, right? The kind of the henchman, effectively, so well. And. And this goes back to Chris's point about how, in some ways, the acting is irrelevant. I actually found it very Kubrickian in the way that he basically just sort of treats his actors like props. He's filming them like objects. He's like, no, I'm going to put you here. And then maybe you will move your arm this one place. And that's what we're going to do. But like, I mean, sure, there's more movement than that. But I'm joking a little bit. But if you go back and you watch Kubrick's films, especially from, you know, the 70s, 80s, like the up to the Shining era, Barry Lyndon in particular, he's creating paintings effectively, except in front of the camera and then filming them. And Villeneuve is doing something very, very similar. He doesn't work with color in the same way that Kubrick does. Kubrick, you know, it's had all of these kind of interesting naturalistic colors and really interesting lighting scapes. And Villeneuve is very much a, is not, is, Viennese stuff is super interesting, but it's super monochrome as well, right? It's always like, here's a sort of single dominant color and then blacks on top of it, right? So he's almost shooting as if the film is black and white. It's just that instead of being black and white, it's black and like a deep, weird green, black and a, you know, a sandy brown, black, right? And it's, so it's, there's this kind of monochrome black and white aspect to it. But then all of the images are just posed so perfectly as if they are, almost as if the actors are little action figures that Villeneuve is playing with, because Villeneuve is the one who is determining what acting will happen and which and what acting will not happen. The actors are not turning in performances where they're making the choices themselves in some sense.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Dune? Peter, you've been very skeptical of the movie so far. Did you like it?
Huge thumbs up.
Chris?
Yeah, thumbs up. You know, I have reservations and again, as we've discussed, I do think there is a sort of bait and switch element, especially for people who haven't been paying close attention to what's going on with the movie, but utterly worth watching. And I look forward to the second part.
Thumbs incomplete. That's what I would. No, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. I hope we get a sequel. It looks like, I mean, by the time this comes out, Warner Brothers may have already greenlit the sequel. We'll see. But I think the numbers this weekend, it looks like it's going to gross about $40 million, are solid enough to give them a little more confidence as they reach for that green light. So hopefully we get Dune Part 2 soon. All right, that is it for this week's episode of Across the Movie Aisle. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on Denis Villeneuve's work. And make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And we're like sandworms. If we don't grow, we die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys again next week.